Welcome to the VA HSR&D Investigator Insights podcast series. In this episode, Query Dissemination Coordinator Diane Hanks speaks with Dr. Alicia Cohen of the HSR&D Center for Long-Term Services and Supports for Vulnerable Veterans about her work in the area of food insecurity among veterans.
First, I wanted to talk about the notion of food insecurity because I think it's probably a term that a lot of people aren't familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's actually a number of definitions of food insecurity. Mm-hmm. One that's used fairly commonly and that I'd like is one that the USDA uses, mm-hmm. which is limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods. So I think one thing about that is it's a lot of times people think about financial barriers to accessing mm-hmm. food, which is actually absolutely a huge piece of it and a huge barrier, but then also...
But not the whole piece.
Not the whole piece. And so access as well, whether it's, you know, are you living someplace where there's nutritionally adequate and safe food available? Mm-hmm. Are you disabled or elderly or frail and homebound and having difficulty accessing food? There can mm-hmm. be a number of things that can impact food availability and mm-hmm. access.
And I've heard... I know there's been some focus on people who live in urban areas and just not having access.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, access can really vary very much by locality and region. And I actually mm-hmm. remember one conversation I was having with someone actually in Detroit, and she was saying that she didn't have access to a car.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
There wasn't good public transportation near her that could take her to any kind of major, you know, grocery store mm-hmm. or supermarket. And so she was primarily reliant on the corner store and gas station for kind of her day-to-day food.
Yeah.
And, you know, this really compelling quote that stayed with me, she said, I can get banana-flavored pudding, but I can't get bananas. And so, you know, that's one of those things where, mm-hmm. again, you know, cost is a huge piece, and also mm-hmm. Sort of nutritionally adequate foods are mm-hmm. often just much more expensive than sort of mm-hmm. the calorie-dense, nutrient-poor junk foods.
Right.
So a lot of times people will sort of, you know, end up getting junk food or, you know, like a box of pasta mm-hmm. that can feed your family
right.
for less than a cost than the cost of a piece of fruit.
Right.
And so people are having to make decisions about how to stretch limited funds.
Right.
And then when you layer on kind of, you know, what's available and, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that, you know, certainly in urban areas there are very specific barriers, and some urban mm-hmm. areas have, you know, really robust urban farming mm-hmm. and, you know, other food resources available. So I know people sort of talk about the term, you know, quote unquote food desert, mm-hmm. Which actually is kind of a controversial term anyway, but thinking
right.
about there's just so many components that go into food access, and mm-hmm. People living in rural areas can, you know, face other barriers to food access. So it's really a very kind of individualized.
And I think it's misunderstood because I think people look at homeless people and they think, oh, they're not getting enough food. But if you're not homeless mm-hmm. and they look at you, and especially because there's such a problem with being overweight and obesity among veterans, among the general population, and they look at people who are overweight or obese and they think, well, they're getting enough food, obviously, but they're not getting the right food. They're getting the foods that are going to bring on diabetes or that aren't healthy for them.
Yeah, it's a huge misperception. I mean,
yes,
obviously, not having enough food is bad for your health, mm-hmm. but not having enough
the right,
of the right
food.
Foods is also bad to your health. And we actually see that food insecurity is absolutely associated with higher rates of and poorer control of obesity, diabetes, hypertension, you know, high cholesterol, mm-hmm. all kinds of diet-related conditions, for the very reason that sort of the junk food is both more readily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it at the corner stores, the gas stations, the vending mm-hmm. machines, any place, and it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And so often that's kind of where people go to stretch their dollars,
yeah.
particularly if they're trying to provide not only for themselves but also
but for
their family. Yeah.
Right.
And so, it's a big issue. And the other thing that I kind of am constantly talking to people about, and particularly clinicians,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, I say our eyeball test is really poor. You cannot
yes.
tell looking at somebody.
No, if they're hungry.
No,
you can't.
You cannot tell if somebody is
no.
struggling to put food on the table. You can't
exactly.
tell if somebody is struggling to pay their rent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we need to ask. Which is part of why, you know, this work is so important, why the VA clinical reminder is so important, because if we're not asking, we're not going to know.
So tell us about your study and how you hope that it will have an impact on people who don't have access to enough good food.
Yeah, absolutely. So the, you know, VA has really kind of been a national leader in trying to address social determinants of health, particularly homelessness, and more recently has really been looking at food insecurity. And in July of 2017, actually, based on a pilot by Tom O'Toole and colleagues, and so based on that, they actually found in the homeless packs, almost 15% of veterans who were homeless or had housing instability also reported food insecurity. And then in November of 2015, there were congressional briefings on veteran food insecurity, which then actually spurred the charter of a VHA ensuring veteran food security work group that was really tasked with trying to both, you know, understand the scope of veteran food insecurity and ways to better address it. And one of the outgrowths of that work group, of which Tom O'Toole and Callie Thomas, who are co-authors on this study, were founding members of the work group. One of the outgrowths was this clinical reminder. So in July of 2017, the Food Insecurity Clinical Reminder was piloted at six sites across the country. And then in October of 2017, the Food Insecurity Clinical Reminder was rolled out nationally. And the goal of the reminder, which has actually been incorporated into the homelessness clinical reminder, which has been in place for quite some time. And so the goal is to screen all veterans who are not currently long-term residents of nursing homes or other long-term care facilities where they're receiving food as part of their, as part of being in a long-term care facility. So to screen all non-institutionalized veterans who are receiving care at the VA for food insecurity at least annually.
Okay, so this isn't just homeless veterans?
This is all veterans.
All veterans, yeah.
All veterans receiving care, all non-institutionalized veterans receiving care at VA are supposed to be screened annually. And so as a clinician working as in primary care at the VA, I actually work in both our homeless pact at the Providence VA and also in the Women's Health Clinic. But for all of primary care providers, and it's actually not even limited to primary care, actually anybody can administer the Food Insecurity Clinical Reminder, and sometimes, not infrequently, it's administered by social workers or potentially by dietitians or by others. And the it's a single question screener that asks about food access. And then if a veteran screens positive, they're then offered a referral to social work and or to a dietitian. And so the clinical reminder was rolled out nationally, and there's uniformity in the question being asked and sort of the specific follow-up protocols that being offered the referrals. But a lot of the other specifics of how it was rolled out was really left up to individual sites in terms of who's administering the screening, you know, in what setting, is it before the visit, is it during the visit, and, you know, how they're asking the question. I mean, it's scripted, but sort of in what context they're asking the question. And then really kind of what the follow-up protocols are, where veterans are offered a referral to social work or and or a dietitian, but then in terms of what happens afterwards, what resources are offered, sort of how that positive screen is addressed, is was really kind of left up to the individual sites, you know, based on their kind of particular culture and resource availability, which is actually another thing that we're looking at, is trying to understand what that variation is nationally. And I'm also actually part of the Ensuring Veteran Food Security Work Group, and sort of part of the conversations that we've been having is really recognizing that this, you know, needs to be an interdisciplinary approach. And so thinking about how, you know, every member of the team really has to come together from potentially the, you know, AMSA who's doing the, potentially who's kind of, you know, rooming the patient and doing the screening, thinking, you know, and or again, it varies by site, because sometimes it's a nurse who's doing the screening, sometimes it's the provider, sometimes, but, you know, as a provider, when someone has a positive screen, you know, I'm thinking about a lot of things. One, I'm thinking about what referrals do I need to place and who do I connect them to try to get them the resources mm-hmm. that they need. But I'm mm-hmm. also thinking, let me look at their medication list. You know, are there any medications they're taking right now that are putting them at risk for hypoglycemia?
Yeah.
Are there any medications that, you know, are they taking their medications? Are they having difficulty affording their medications?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even within VA, thinking mm-hmm. about the fact that co-pays can obviously vary
right.
by veterans and, you know, priority status and other factors. And there was one national study outside of VA, but a mm-hmm. national survey that found that among people reporting at least one chronic medical condition, mm-hmm. One in three said that they were having difficulty having to choose between food and medicine.
Yeah.
And 13% said that they couldn't afford either.
Wow.
So again, you know, if these aren't mm-hmm. questions that we're asking, you know,
right.
of our veterans, and, you know, we sort of talk a lot about, you know, medication adherence and,
yeah.
and are people, you know, quote unquote complying,
yeah.
With what we're doing. And if we're with the treatment that, you know, we're prescribing or
right.
recommending. And I think that we really kind of need to think about, you know,
the basic
the basics mm-hmm. and sort of if people are having difficulty mm-hmm. affording food or housing, you know, or meeting other basic needs,
mm-hmm.
Both kind of, you know, sometimes they will have to choose between food mm-hmm. and medicine or housing and medicine and will make those
mm-hmm.
choices and not be taking their medications. And also sometimes just the tremendous stressors of
mm-hmm.
not being able to provide for themselves and their
mm-hmm.
families can, you know, make it really difficult to juggle a lot of
mm-hmm.
different competing priorities,
mm-hmm.
and can both exacerbate
mm-hmm.
kind of underlying chronic medical conditions and also precipitate
mm-hmm.
new conditions, both mental health related and sort of, you know, like we talked about, you know, can potentially kind of tip somebody over the edge in terms of diabetes or hypertension.
Right. Does food instability affect more veterans who are older, or is it across the board? And I'm wondering, like, with the veterans who have families,
mm-hmm.
if one of the indicators would be, are their children getting so-called free lunch from school?
Yep.
Because that would be an indication that the family can't afford to pay for school lunch, so
mm-hmm.
therefore, you know.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's interesting kind of what we're able to look at using VA data,
mm-hmm.
Which in certain ways is amazing. I mean, it's national data.
Right.
You know, we
right.
have access from, you know, thinking about other things that are available in the medical
mm-hmm.
record that we can look at. But then also thinking about the limitations of things we don't have in the medical
right.
record. Like, you know, we don't know. We don't even necessarily routinely in any kind of way that we can systematically extract, you know,
mm-hmm.
find out
mm-hmm.
how many people are in the household or
yeah,
if there
exactly.
are children. And certainly
yeah.
we don't, I would love it if sometime we could,
mm-hmm.
but we don't routinely, you know, find out are people receiving SNAP food stamps or WIC
right.
or, you know, other federal assistance
mm-hmm.
programs.
But just tackling the stigma must be a big part of what you're doing.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the stigma is very real. I think that, you know, neon sign problem is
mm-hmm.
very real. And there are a number of VAs across the country. We're actually the work group trying to get a tally of it right now, the Ensuring Veteran Food Security Work Group. But we know of at least around 40 VAs across the
mm-hmm.
country who actually have a food pantry on site.
Great.
And then there's a formal partnership with Feeding America.
Mm-hmm.
And there are currently 17, at the moment, 17 VAs. There's more that are currently working with Feeding America to have sort of formal Feeding America
mm-hmm.
partner food banks on site
mm-hmm.
At the VAs, which is an important step. But as you said, if there is stigma, if people...
Yeah,
I wonder
if there's been studies about, you know, you're available for this, but are you taking advantage of it? And if you're not taking advantage of it, is it because you're feeling embarrassed? And is there another way that we can we deliver the food?
Yeah.
Or is there another way we can get it to you so that you don't have to...
It's a great question.
That.
I mean, even in terms of just where, you know, the pantry is located
exactly.
and are people, you know,
exactly.
people going. And we've also kind of anecdotally had, you know, conversations with veterans who, you
mm-hmm.
know, even in terms of federal food assistance programs, thinking about something like SNAP,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they just said, oh, well, no, I'm getting by. I want to leave
mm-hmm.
those benefits for somebody else. Or,
yeah.
you know, not realizing, no, actually, there's actually
yeah.
quite stringent criteria
yeah.
to be able to get SNAP. You have to be...
Mm-hmm.
your net income has to be below 100% of the federal poverty level, which is quite low. And so, you know, if you qualify, in fact, you very much deserve these resources. And I think part of the destigmatizing is really kind of talking about the fact that this is important for you and it's important for your health.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think part of sort of the larger conversations around thinking about social determinants of health and, you know, unmet health-related social needs and really kind of bringing that into the medical and clinical realm is sort of normalizing. These are important conversations to be having. Mm-hmm. And not only, you know, are these okay and appropriate conversations to be having with your provider, but these are necessary. And this is absolutely part of your medical care. And I think that's a huge piece of the conversation we're having both with providers and with veterans and sort of with patients in other settings is, you know, this, you know, our hope is that at least right now, and there's sort of algorithms in terms of, you know, veterans should be screened at minimum once a year for food insecurity, veterans who are identified at higher risk, some of them are being screened more often, but, you know, also knowing that things can, you know, SANS can shift instantaneously, and, you know, people who may be okay when they happen to get screened, you know, a month later or 4 months later might not be. And so I think the other piece is really normalizing this to the extent where even if it's not brought up in a particular visit, hopefully empowering veterans to be able to say, hey, you know what, this is okay to talk about in the same way that you talk about with your provider about any a number of other medical conditions. This is impacting your health and we care.
Yeah.
And we have resources to, you know, to try to help.
Sometimes there are medical conditions that require you to eat certain foods.
And
so just that emphasis on if you want to get well, this is what you need to do and this is how we're going to help you do it.
And that again kind of gets back to that team-based approach. So, I mean, there's been a fair amount of press recently looking at medically tailored meal programs and sort of, you know, home-delivered medically tailored meals. And, you know, Kelly Thomas and David Dosa and some others have done really remarkable work specifically looking at Meals on Wheels with older adults. You know, but I think that one thing is a lot of times people kind of think, oh, somebody screens positive, we click the box for social work referral and, you know, like...
And then we're done. Yeah.
And, you know, again, I kind of think really broadening it to think about what that team-based approach is and, you know, a lot of the efforts, again, with the work group have kind of been thinking about specifically with social work and with nutrition and food services, you know, how do they work together? And so when you have a dietitian who's both sort of able to do a really comprehensive assessment of what a veteran's nutritional needs are, but then also thinking about some of these specific circumstances. So if you have a veteran who, you know, how do they navigate a low-salt diet if they're getting food from a food pantry? Or, you know, if they only have a hot plate where they're living, or they only have a microwave, you know, how can they, or, you know, or they have, you know, other kinds of disabilities, how can they get the assistance that they need and how can they prepare food, both obtain the food, but then also really thinking about preparing it in a way that's nutritionally appropriate for them. And, you know, even thinking about sort of other members of the care team, the, you know, thinking again about medication and pharmacists and kind of trying to help identify other options that, you know, maybe less cost prohibitive. Or thinking even about physical therapy and occupational therapy, and particularly if people are having in-home assessments for other reasons, that's a really unique window into people's life circumstances. And, you know, kind of thinking about, do people have other limitations to food access that we should be thinking about? So this really, I mean, I think the PACT model in general is one that very much applies to this situation. I think it's just important to note some of the, we found that female veterans, veterans of color were at increased risk for food insecurity using the screener. We also interestingly found that overall, veterans under 65 were actually at higher risk for food insecurity, and there have been other studies to show that Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans are at much higher risk for food insecurity, and those veterans who are recently returning from active service are at higher risk for a number of reasons. And then I think when you kind of do sub-analyses looking specifically at older veterans, we do find that they are uniquely at risk in different ways. So there's a lot of complexity around it. And then the other thing that we found, just in terms of who is particularly at risk for food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
So not surprisingly, lower income veterans mm-hmm. are at higher risk, but then also veterans with depression, veterans with a trauma history,
yeah.
PTSD, military sexual trauma
mm-hmm.
absolutely places people at higher risk
mm-hmm.
for food insecurity. And, you know, so I think the other pieces, both stressing the need for kind of universal screening, because again, we can't tell looking at somebody, you know, whether or
mm-hmm.
not they're food insecure, but then also thinking about some of these groups that we know are at higher risk
mm-hmm.
and, you know, maybe doing both targeted screening within those groups. So maybe if we
mm-hmm.
find out that someone, you know, has experienced military sexual trauma, knowing that they, you know, are then also at higher risk for food insecurity
mm-hmm.
when we're thinking about trauma-informed care and
yeah.
trauma-informed care lens, you
mm-hmm.
know, maybe we should specifically be, I would say that we should indeed specifically,
mm-hmm.
among the other things we're screening for,
mm-hmm.
ask about, you know, food and housing and economic stability, and then
yeah.
even thinking about ways that we can target interventions
mm-hmm.
Target and tailor interventions
mm-hmm.
to specific high-risk populations, recognizing that it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all.
Right.
And so that's really where a lot of our work is focusing, is both the kind of,
right.
you know, understand just the scope of veteran food insecurity in general,
mm-hmm.
And this
mm-hmm.
work is obviously limited to those veterans receiving care
mm-hmm.
at the VA, but understand the scope and then who's at risk, but sort of the other work that we're doing right now is looking at variation across sites,
mm-hmm.
trying to characterize different implementation
mm-hmm.
experiences and really kind of identify some, hopefully, some promising practices.
Yeah.
And then the other key piece, and this kind of gets back to something you mentioned earlier, is that we're really hoping to do interviews with veterans to hear about
yeah.
their experiences.
Yeah.
To hear about their experiences of food insecurity in general,
mm-hmm.
Longitudinally, and also to hear about their experiences with the screening and referral process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what happened once they got screened? What resources were they offered? Did they take advantage of them?
Yeah, were they comfortable?
If they didn't take advantage of them, kind of what were the barriers? What got in the way? You know, were
yeah.
their needs met? What outstanding needs still remain? You know,
mm-hmm.
so that we can really try to figure out how we can, obviously screening is an essential first step,
mm-hmm.
but it's a means to an end. We want to screen so we can find out who's food insecure,
right.
so then we can try to help address it.
Right.
And so I think, you know, really the direction of the future work is figuring out how we can best address
mm-hmm.
those needs and how we can
mm-hmm.
best tailor and individualize responses.
Right.
In a way that's also scalable.
Right.
And so that's kind of, you know, where we're moving next.
And it, you feel like you're getting the support that you need in the VA and that it's a good place to conduct this research? And
I am incredibly grateful to be doing this work in the VA. I think it is an extremely supportive environment. I think it's an extremely receptive environment. I will say, particularly as a physician researcher, I, you know, am very proud to be a provider within the VA, and I'm so grateful daily for being in an integrated healthcare system, particularly the fact that I'm working with high-risk populations in terms
mm-hmm.
of homeless veterans and female veterans, and the resources that we have available, and, you know, kind of the fact that when I, you know, I'm with somebody, and then if I need you know, mental health services or a connection with social work or a connection
mm-hmm.
with a dietitian or sort of any number of needs that, you know, sometimes it's literally right next door.
Right.
Or I pick up the phone, I know who to call, you know, I can connect people in a way that I wasn't able to.
Right.
When I was outside of the VA. So the integrated healthcare model is just an incredible place to be.
Right.
And then I think there's a really kind of unique integration of you know, thinking about clinical care and
mm-hmm.
and research and just the support for research and you know, I mean this sincerely, kind of thinking within the HSR&D and query realms, I think that there's both a tremendous brain trust to draw
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very supportive environment, particularly for an early career researcher, so I'm very grateful
yeah.
for that.
Great.
The views and opinions expressed in the preceding podcast are concerned with the scope of recently concluded or ongoing VA HSR&D funded research and do not necessarily reflect current or to be implemented VA policy. To learn more about this research, visit the VA HSR&D website at www.hsrd.research.va.gov. hsrnd.gov.